Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good morning, everyone. I hope it's warmer where you are.
Well, Mom, we have a really great, interesting, very personal memoir writer with us today.
Yes, we do.
Don Waters, author of These Boys and Their Fathers. And Don is the author also of Sunland, a novel, and two story collections, The Saints of Rattlesnake Mountain and Desert Gothic, which won the Iowa Short Fiction Award. His fiction has been widely published and anthologized in the Pushcart Prize, Best of the West, and New Stories from the Southwest. He's a frequent contributor to the San Francisco Chronicle. He's written for the New York Times Book Review, Outside, The Believer, Tin House, and Slate, and many more. Don is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop and teaches at Lewis and Clark College. He lives in Portland, Oregon, with his partner, the writer Robin Rahm, and their daughter. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Don.
Thank you very much. I should probably amend that last part because we now have another daughter, so daughters.
Oh, daughters. Congratulations.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And you do address the kind of effort to become parents a little bit in the book, don't you?
Most definitely. It was a really long process of, you know, trying to have our first daughter. And we started, I think, probably a decade ago. We finally, you know, 3 years ago became parents. And then we became parents again, by surprise, 5 months ago.
Wow. I mean, I assume you weren't surprised at the time she was born, but.
Oh, no. But we weren't sort of,
surprise!
You know, yeah.
But so.
And you'll also notice or hear maybe a little bit of congestion in my voice right now, which I apologize for. But, you know, having a three-year-old, we have, you know, colds just, you know, come through our house frequently now. So I'm sort of perpetually sick.
Yeah, I remember what that was like. Although,
So, oh, yeah, been there.
5 times she's been there.
yeah, that's wonderful.
And it's interesting, I had two children. They were 3.5 years apart many years ago. I think my kids are about your age, Don. And I found that having two children was more than twice as hard as having one. More than twice as much.
Well, it's like I tell all my friends, you have one kid and you have one kid, you know, and it's just one kid. But when you have two kids, it's like having five kids.
Yeah.
All of your time sort of goes away in all the, you know, where all the sleep times and all that. It's just everything collapses. And so you're just sort of going through the first 6 months trying to survive. That's sort of where we're sort of just getting out of that now.
And with one child, one of you can take a break now and then. With two, it's a lot harder.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I also just want to say they're also just amazing.
Of course.
Totally, absolutely amazing. It's just the parenting part that's surprising.
And in the middle of all of this, your new book came out, These Boys and Their Fathers.
Right.
And when is it? Is it on the stands now? Is it out or is it coming out or what's the publishing date?
Yeah, it's October, October 1st.
Okay.
So when I was at the Iowa Book Fest, it was out, and it was at the bookstores with prayer lights there. And then just this week, it finally made it to the shelves of the local Powell's. So we know that it's there, and it's making its way around. But, you know, when a book gets released, it's sort of, unless it's this, you know, Stephen King, you know, mega bestseller, it's going to show up really, really early. It sort of makes its way out there that month or that month after.
Right.
So it's out there now.
It's out there. And now you just mentioned two of probably the best independent bookstores in the whole country. Prairie Lights in Iowa City and Powell's
right.
in Portland. I've only been to Portland once, but of course I had to go check out Powell's. And then there's the third, Book People in Austin. And as we were talking about earlier, I spend quite a bit of time in Austin. So, I mean, aren't those like the top three in the country practically?
You know what's funny is I actually did a little sort of online whatever article for Tin House a while, like I don't know, a little while ago when one of my books was coming out, and it was I just lived so many different places in the country that all these little bookstores became my little home, and so I did an article about all at every little place, which was San Francisco and Berkeley and Santa Fe, Iowa City, Portland, and they all have wonderful bookstores. Like Santa Fe has Collected Works, Prairie Lights is in Iowa City, Powell's in Portland, and then in San Francisco, it was this local bookstore called Green Light or Sir Green, sorry, not Green, Green Light, Green Apple Books, which was sort of where I actually got a lot of my education because I moved there pretty soon after college, and it was a bookstore that was in my neighborhood, and I would go over there and literally just in the fiction section go from A to Z and just look at all the different, authors, because where I was from, I didn't have a bookstore like that, and so I would just go from A to Z and just try to, figure out who these authors were, what they were writing, and they had all kinds of different magazines about writing and zines, and it was just this huge education for me, and I love that place. So I actually wrote about that place too.
Well, obviously I love local bookstores. We have a great one here, Revelations Bookstore, which is also a restaurant bookstore. And this is a
Oh,
small town of Fairfield, 10,000 people, and we still have a great independent bookstore. But I got to admit, I still do like Barnes and Noble too.
wow. I mean, there's some. I think that there are some Barnes and Nobles in some parts of the country. That's like, a hub, where you don't have alternatives. I mean, it's a hub for, people meeting in the cafes, and if you get some employees there that know what they're doing, they'll stack the shelves with really cool books.
I don't know. I guess there is no such thing as a bad bookstore.
That's right.
I'm sure.
I like that philosophy.
That's a good one.
So, Don, at what point in your life did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I never set out to quote unquote be a writer. I come from, I was born and raised in Reno, Nevada, and it's a really provincial town. And it's one of those towns where, if you have a Barnes and Noble, it is the sort of lifeblood for, local writers or something like that. But there were very few places to sort of find alternative, visions. And so I found those in mostly, like, there is a really great bookstore in Reno, Sundance Books. And then I also found it in my local record store, and I found it by way of, zines, those little sort of handmade, magazines by, music fans. And, so I was really enthralled by that, and I was really into, punk rock music and, sort of, I don't know, quote unquote, alternative music or something. And, I started making my own zine when I was, 19 years old or 18 years old. And these things were amazing because I could put them together and write the articles and do the band interviews. And it was just such a creative thing. And it wasn't me trying to, become a writer. It was me trying to be creative, and do something creative with my life. And, it was really fulfilling. I mean, some of them were really, stupid, the stuff that I wrote about. Because it was just me at that point kind of being angry at the world and interviewing these punk bands and saying, "Are you angry too?" And we're all angry. And so I put these things together, and it was really fulfilling because I could then advertise them in magazines, and then people from all over the world would send me a dollar, and I would send this out to, I don't know, New Mexico or Arizona. And, I would get, not fan letters, but letters of like appreciation of, "Hey, I'm glad that you're doing this," from, places like Japan, all over the place.
Did you actually
And
make
so that
money
was,
doing it?
oh no, it was, you just lose money. It's like you get some local record store and some bands that sort of give you, you know, some merchandise or a little bit of money, but you're basically just doing it out of your own pocket. And so when I did that in college, you know, it was really fun. And then, simultaneously I was taking, you know, literature classes, and I never really took a writing class in college. I actually mentored with somebody, or I was a sort of, there was a mentor of mine who was a writer in college, and I did an independent study where I wrote a novel. And so that's sort of, it was sort of a weird confluence of things, because I loved writing, and I loved writing, you know, nonfiction and doing band interviews. And then what really turned me on was this one class. It was the, you know, Art of the Novel. And I remember reading Nabokov's Pale Fire, and that book blew my mind because it just showed me all the different ways you could go about writing a novel, because I was so used to, you know, reading books, and they had this sort of same story arc, and they were the high school novels, and everybody sort of, you know, reads them, and it's like taking your vitamins. And then I got to Nabokov, and he was amazing to me. And so I sort of just sat down and I said, I want to try this. I want to try to, you know, be that. And be, you know, nobody could ever be Nabokov, but Nabokov. But I just wanted to try it. And so for my senior year, I sat down and I wrote a 400-page novel. And I worked with a writer named Tatiana Tolstoya, and she was a Russian writer. She actually lives in Moscow now. And we just talked about writing, and she sort of opened my eyes to different ways of, you know, thinking about writing. And that's sort of when I knew I wanted to go down this path, you know, however dubious a path it is. And then soon after, you know, I sort of, like I say in the memoir, you know, I followed the cliche and I moved to San Francisco to, you know, become a writer.
Right. Now, in your memoir, there's a section where you're talking about these zines and in college, and you went out and bought 5,000 copies, had them printed.
Right.
Before that, I think you'd been photocopying and stapling. And now you went out and had them professionally printed, 5,000 copies. How many of those do you still have left?
I can't find one.
Really?
It's weird. It was, so what I would do is, you know, you would go to the copy store and do your first, you know, zines, and you'd staple them together and, you know, fold them and make it look like a book. And then for, I think it was my third or fourth issue or something like that, I wanted to make it look like, you know, the old TV inserts, that would, you know, show all the shows. And it was sort of like, it was a little sort of booklet. Mm-hmm. And so I went down to the local, I just did this on my own. I just said, I want to do this. And so I have that kind of personality where I just want to do something and I'll just go to the source. And so I went to the local newspaper plant and I said, how do I do this? And they told me how to do it. And they gave me these blue lines, these huge pieces of paper. And I laid it all out. And, you know, the smallest order was 5,000. And I had no idea what that was going to look like. And so when I finally showed up, these things were on pallets. They were several pallets. And I was like, we don't have enough, you know, room in the car for this. And so I stacked them like columns in my dorm room. And these things went everywhere. Everywhere I could go, anytime I traveled outside of town, I would drop, you know, I'd take a bundle of them and just drop them in a coffee shop or something. And they just went everywhere. So yeah, that was a learning experience.
Well, it reminds me of, you know, I'm old enough to remember when writers who self-published, we didn't have, you know, print on demand and so forth. So you had to buy at least 1,000 copies of your book, and you'd have, and often more, to get a decent price. And so you'd have boxes and boxes of books
in your
garage.
Unless you're, you know, Virginia Woolf and, you know, her husband, and they had a printing press in their living room where you could just print your own books.
Which would be kind of cool. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Don Waters, author of These Boys and Their Fathers, a memoir. Now, there's two things I want to ask, and Mom, jump in when you can, because I've got, I'm full of questions.
Yeah, sure.
But are zines still a thing? Or is everything online now?
I think for a while it went online, but it's coming back. It's sort of, I think, the nostalgia of it. And also just there's something you can't get by putting something online that you can get by putting something together with your own hands. Mm. It's like reading something, you know, online, or it's like writing, right, you know, directly into the computer. There's something more fulfilling with writing by hand into a journal. I think that you learn, you know, better that way, taking notes by hand. There's something just about, putting it together and figuring it out, and using your own hands that's really pleasing. There are zines out there. In fact, I think at University of Iowa, it was either in the library or the student center, they had a big vending machine full of zines. And so instead of getting a Snickers, you could put, you know, a couple quarters in and get somebody's zine. And I know that, yeah. So I think that's still there. And there are zine libraries. I know that there are some universities that, you know, purchase complete zine libraries, and they have that. And I think some of mine are there. Oh, God, it terrifies me to think they're still out there. But in Portland, you can go to Powell's and there's a whole section for zines. So they're still definitely out there, and there's people who do appreciate them. Wow.
And then the next thing, you know, you talked about being angry as a young man. You know, that kind of ties back to your book, These Boys and Their Fathers, because it sounds like from reading the book that a lot of your anger was wrapped up around not having a father in your life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. It wasn't just not having a father. It was the whole experience of not knowing, you know, where he was for, you know, my entire, you know, formative childhood, who he was, what his, you know, what he looked like. And then sort of being, you know, sort of kept away from him and his family, and also just having any information about him. So, you know, the way that my mom dealt with it was, I'd say, where is he, you know, as a child? And she'd just say, he doesn't know how to be a father, and that would be it. So when you're a kid, you kind of learn to not ask those questions, because you, you know, you sort of know that that's going to be the answer. So there was anger, you know, definitely my mom. I love my mom, but there was anger. With her about that. And then there's anger definitely about the man who left, because, it's a really unique, and I want to say, you know, this seriously, it's a tragic experience, because not knowing who your father is, and knowing also that your father left and just abandoned you, you start, you know, internalizing that, thinking it's thinking that, you know, this is a part of you, your father. And, you know, If that's the person who, you know, is your father, what's that going to make you? There's a lot of self-blame. And so all of these things, you know, questions of self-worth, you know, am I worth nothing? And so, you know, a lot of these things I've worked out through therapy, but I only got into therapy when I was in my 20s. And so, you know, my mid-20s. And so when I was, you know, a teenager, plus, you know, the teenage years, you're so full of, you know, hormones in it anyway. But, you know, from a teenager until my early 20s, I was wildly, wildly furious. And it was because I was so sad, mm-hmm. you know, it was because I was so sad about this. And I didn't know how to express it. And that's the thing, when you don't know how to express it or know how to process it, it comes out through wild anger.
Yeah.
I noted on page 47, I wrote this down because it was without a father around, I questioned again and again my worth as a person, my very existence. And I can see how you would feel that way. And it drove your life at that point.
And it was also, you know, simultaneously the time when he was trying to come into my life. You know, it's really something when your father basically takes off, abandons you, there's no contact, and then around your 18th birthday, tries to get in contact with me with a "Hey buddy," you know, card in the mail and a $50 check. If that won't make somebody incredibly angry. I don't know what will. And so, yeah, so he, you know, wanted to meet me, and it took me, you know, a whole year of just trying to figure out even if I wanted to meet him. So yeah, I mean, it was a really, you know, interesting experience.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, I mean, it was a formative part of me.
Don, in the book, you have the letter that you wrote back to him. And
yes. It
was actually very polite.
Yes.
You didn't express any of that in your letter. Did you ever get a chance to express that, those feelings
to your
father?
Okay. So that my book starts with a letter from me after I basically got that card.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically that letter saying, okay, yeah, I can meet you, and here's who I am. And, you know, there's this spark at the very beginning when I did receive that, where I was really confused. I was so angry, but I was also hopeful. So I wrote that back to him, and then we basically had a back and forth game of letter writing. And over that time, when I was, you know, writing these letters, they grew angrier and angrier and angrier. And then we met, and then I essentially wrote him the angriest letter I've ever written anyone, and contact was broken off for, I think, maybe 9 years or something like that. And then finally, we started to see each other again. So it was really like, you know, I was hopeful for a second. And then after that, I was, my true feelings actually did come through.
Well, what about his parents? Did they ever make any effort to get in touch with
no,
their grandson?
No. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is one of my questions. I mean, it's funny because people are like, well, what about all these other people? And they just weren't in my life. His whole family was not, I didn't know who they were. I didn't know where they lived. I didn't know what they looked like. Nothing. So his parents were, you know, meanwhile, living their life. He had sisters. They had, you know, I had cousins. I had a whole family out there that it was essentially denied me, because of, his decisions and, you know, my mom's decisions. So yeah, nobody ever reached out. Nobody ever reached out to me.
In some ways that surprises me more than your father, not. And was it possible, though, that your father was trying to reach out to you, but your mother blocked it until you were 18?
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I actually don't know. I sort of from what I've sort of pieced together, and I'm still piecing this together, I'll probably be piecing it together for the rest of my life. There is this incident in the book that, you know, sort of the reasons, you know, that from my mom's perspective of why, and from her perspective, I can see why, she didn't want to have anything to do with him. But sort of what I've pieced together is he was actually afraid because of what happened. The violence and all that. Mm-hmm. He was afraid to get in touch. Mm-hmm. My family now that I know on his side, told me that, I think it was my grandparents that facilitated him coming back into my life. So, they actually helped out with that.
And did you get to establish a relationship with your grandparents before they passed?
Yeah. And they were amazing people, which is, really, I mean, they were just really amazing. My grandmother was from Liverpool originally. My grandfather, you know, was from the LA area, and, you know, they met in San Francisco, and he was an opera singer at one point in his life. I mean, they were really just interesting, interesting people, and had the same political beliefs that I do. And, it was really a joy to get to know them.
But they sent you a photograph album at one point too, didn't they?
After my father died, they would send me. That's why I have that letter that begins the book. they sent me some of his belongings. I still have those.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Don Waters, author of These Boys and Their Fathers, a memoir. Now, Don, in the book, you talk a lot about not writing a memoir about your relationship with your father, that you started it a couple times, you got fairly far along, put it and threw it away, started again, and then on the third attempt, you just decide, no, I'm not doing this. So, but here we have this book. So,
right.
What changed? what allowed you to actually be able to write this?
I think what changed is I changed. Those first two attempts, I had two attempts at a memoir before this, and my first attempt was in my early 20s. And I look back on that attempt as, that's kind of like my anger manifesto. And then my other attempts when, I was in my, I think, almost 30, it was poetic and lyrical and, and quite frankly, pretentious, because I was sort of trying to get at this thing through like lyricism, and that just wasn't going to work. When I, started sort of this journey, I guess, or this quest, what really kicked it into high gear was, I was always wanting to write about this subject. I just never, ever knew how to do it. I discovered in my father, when he found out I was a writer, he wrote an autobiography of his life so that I would know who he was. And in the book, I talk about this, and it took me a while to actually open it and read it. And it was, so by chapters of his life, like his childhood, his college years, the time he was in the Navy, when he was a surfer. So I was really enthralled by his surfing chapter. And I was, into surfing. And so that felt to me like a connection. When everything else in our, relationship was disconnection, that one subject was a connection for me. And so I pursued, that topic, surfing, and, pitched an article for a magazine, for Outside Magazine. And, it was all centered around, me building a surfboard with this, icon of surfing, Greg Knoll, who, grew up down the street from my father in Manhattan Beach and gave my father his first surfboard. So I wrote that article. You can't really get into, everything in a magazine piece. And so after I wrote that, I said, I really want to continue to do this, this memoir. But I don't know how to do it. And so I've essentially used all the tools in the writer's toolbox to write this memoir, and that includes fiction. There's a short story from my father's point of view. There's investigative journalism. There's actual memoir. So I just used everything I knew to stitch it together, and with the straight narrative line of just me wanting to, get at this one subject, my relationship to my father. And sometimes you have to, you can't go to, you can't, get at something straight on. You have to maybe go at it sideways. And so with this memoir, I went at it sideways in many different ways, but it ties together. There's adhesive to it because it's all about my relationship to my father. And trying to get it, and discovering the truth, and then me becoming a father or trying to become a father and figuring out how to do that. How do you become a father when you've never had that, influence in your life?
Don, why don't you read a little bit from These Boys and Their Fathers?
Okay. Sure. I'm going to start on page 7. I never knew my father in any meaningful way. Even at 37, after a decade of therapy, I still find it painful to acknowledge this truth. Any man whose father leaves can understand the shame, confusion, and anger generated by such primal loss. Early on, Mom often joked she was Mom and Dad. I was her only kid, and she provided for me. She managed, but it never kept me from wondering, during those lean years when we shared a bunk in a tiny one-bedroom apartment in downtown Reno, Nevada, if our situation might have been different with a father around. Along the way, she enlisted men from her clerical job at the Sheriff's Department jail to dole out nuggets of paternal advice. I remember one evening, when I was around 11, sitting down with a homicide detective who, badge on his belt, holstered gun between us on the dining room table, wanted to talk to me, man to man, about sex. I never knew anything about my father throughout my childhood or teenage years, his whereabouts, what he looked like, what he did for a living, nothing. Whenever someone asked about him, I felt ashamed and I lied. He was faceless, a phantom. His absence grew inside me like an expanding void. The idea of him living in the world somewhere out there haunted me. Did my entrance into the world cause him to leave? Was I worth nothing? With him gone, I still needed guidance, and I looked to my friends' fathers for cues. I absorbed their attention as leaves did sunlight, and I quietly learned which ones to appoint as role models. Why he left remains a mystery. Why he stayed away is another mystery. That part of my family history is full of holes and silence. The questions I've asked over the years yield bewildering answers. As unbelievable as it may seem, I've been unable to get any family member on either side to share more than a few scant details. Whenever I ask Mom, which doesn't happen because she's built a moat around the subject, adorned with decapitated heads on spikes, she's likely to say, "Why do you dwell on this so much? You're just like your grandmother." Her mother, my grandmother, never knew her father either. She was illegitimate, abandoned, and raised by nuns. Over time, the topic of my father slid from taboo to never discussed. I was left to unearth my own pieces of truth. Years ago, Mom offered a brief whisper of insight, a quick peek at a long-ago drama before her curtain crashed down. The information spilled out during a fight. It's like that with her. Information leaks out slowly, like flammable gas, threatening to ignite if I demand too much too fast. I learned early on to curb my curiosity and bottle it. There have been low murmurs about violence and betrayal, but no one has ever given me a complete or satisfactory story, and stories are important to understanding a life. On my 18th birthday, my father reentered my life via Hallmark card. Tucked inside the card was a check in the amount of $50. His signature was in cursive, the ink he used blue. Few people can recall the details of nearly every moment spent with their father, but I can. I met him 5 times as an adult, and each time our disconnection was obvious and massive. But those few times we did share are permanently etched in my memory. During our final encounter in 2009, my father lay in a mechanical hospital bed in a seaside city north of Seattle. The moment I walk into his room, I notice how extremely overweight he is and how bloated. His chin disappears into a pillow of fat that his head rests on. His skin is loose and speckled with purple bruises. An oxygen tube bisects his face. I walk over and stand beside his bed, waiting for him to recognize me. I brought along the day's newspaper. I don't know why. I wanted to bring him something, an offering, a gift. He sees me but doesn't see me. His eyes close and open, and he says in a gravelly voice, "I'm a hostage here. This is a hostage situation." "You're a hostage?" I ask. He doesn't recognize me. "He needs water," he says, "and will I fetch him a tall glass? Please, please, will I do it? Will I help a man in need?" There's a sign on his door that reads, "Fluids restricted." "You're not supposed to have water," I say. "I'm sorry." My original game plan was ruined the moment I saw electrodes running from his chest to a heart monitor. I wanted to confront him to finally demand explanations, but now it's impossible. I'm scared I might say something that could literally kill him, though that bitter thought does course through my mind. Here's the man who left. Here's the man who didn't pay a dime or lift a telephone to place a call. Here's the man I want to love and be loved by. I imagine unleashing my pain on him, 30 years of accumulated outrage, and watching the lines on his heart monitor freak out, beeping, beeping, beeping. I stand by the window. It's a gray spring day walled by fog. I turn around. Talking with him is difficult. I have to wait for rare moments when the clouds in his eyes part and he appears to be somewhat cognizant. At the moment, he isn't. There's a vendetta against me in this hospital, he says quietly. If you don't act now, I won't be here this afternoon. His illness creates fear that manifests as paranoia. He describes developing plots. Doctors roam the hallways, he says, conspiring to kill him. I don't know what to say. For an hour, I sit with him and listen to his delusions. Nurses visit the doorway. We talk in low tones about his condition, which seems to elevate his suspicions. His eyes go wide as he watches us talk. I take my laptop from my backpack and set it on the tray table. I want to show him a slideshow of recent events from my life. A trip to Romania with Robin, my friends, my dog on a Pacific Ocean beach with a tennis ball in her mouth. I want to show him what his son has been doing, but he's not interested. Why do I keep doing this to myself? Besides, he's not really here, and he's unaware of that I'm floating. I'm half in the room, bewildered and unnerved to be near him in his presence. Eventually, he falls asleep. Another quiet hour passes. When he wakes up, he turns his head and his eyes land on me, and suddenly his gaze feels alert and genuine. He tears up, and for a moment, he's here. He sees me. He says my name. He knows me. He knows who I am. Son, he says in a dry whisper, hello. I feel my heartbeat in my head. I stand. I need to speak with his doctor immediately. I need to know what to expect. I need to know what the final countdown would look like. I head to the nurse's station. The head nurse is a bosomy, long fingernailed, bright lipstick woman who talks fast and seems extremely competent. But I don't care. I ask to speak to his doctor. She's flipping through a medical chart on the other side of the counter and doesn't seem to hear me. I state my request again. She says, your father's been giving us trouble. He told me earlier he wasn't pregnant. Wasn't pregnant, I say? What? He lifted his gown, showed me his stomach, and insisted he was not pregnant. But thankfully, we've managed to get him down from 324 to 279. The diuretic is doing its work. He's not pregnant? I can't handle this shit. I need to speak with his doctor, I say again. I want to know what's going on. I can answer your questions, she says. No, I want to speak with his doctor. Not you, his doctor. The doctor's at lunch, she says, and she reiterates she can answer any questions. I meet her eyes. I'm not messing around. I raise my voice. I want his doctor on the phone right now. I stalk around the nursing desk, and she stands and takes a step back. There's still time, I want to say. There's still time. She has the doctor on the phone within minutes, but the doctor can't tell me anything either, other than to say my father is only using 23% of his heart. His heart is a bruised fruit. He could die within the week, the doctor states matter-of-factly, or he could live 6 more months. People surprise us all the time. No one has answers. When I return to his room, he's sitting upright. Foggy light reaches through the window and accentuates the stubble on his chin. He looks rough. He looks worn. He needs a shave. Another nurse walks in behind me and adjusts his pillows. She glances at an electric razor on a shelf above the bed. Then she looks at me, and unaware of our history, she casually asks if I wouldn't mind. He hasn't shaved for a few days, she says. You want to help out? I feel tremendous sorrow for him, and I also feel he's gotten what he deserves. He looks at me with puffy, bloodshot eyes. His breathing is labored. I walk over and grab the razor off the shelf, on which also sits a personal Bible with gold-gilded pages. Thank you for visiting me, he says. He smells ripe, some combination of body oil and dead, dry skin. God, I hate him. God, I love him. But I have no idea if that's the truth. I'll probably always carry around anger and resentment. But I know, as we look at each other, I want to show him just once what it means to have a son.
And that was Don Waters reading from These Boys and Their Fathers, a memoir.
That's really, yep. That was really a good thing to read from this. Good choice.
Yeah, I thought so too. You know, that's funny. I when I was reading from that section about a month ago, I mean, that was the section I was in Iowa City for the festival, and that's I completely teared up when I hadn't read that out loud for people. And so I was hoping I wasn't going to tear up and, you know, get a bigger frog in my voice. But I was, you know, joking with a friend beforehand, you know, should I read the excruciating part or the really excruciating part to the audience? But, I try to balance the, you know, the really heavy stuff about, you know, what this memoir is about with lighter things as well.
Right.
You know, my investigation into another family. You know, my foibles of trying to date, you know, all those things.
Let's talk about
funny,
let's talk about some of that. Let's talk about the other Don Waters.
Sure.
Because you do, that's what you say, your investigation into another family. So when you were, somehow you Googled your own name, I guess, and you were looking,
well,
I remember, you were looking for some of your credits to put in a new CV and
go for it.
And so you found this, some of these credits under your name that weren't yours.
I discovered this other Don Waters, and there was a Don Waters, there was a Scottish guy who lived in, you know, Asheville, North Carolina, and had this really adventurous life, and he was a writer, and he wrote all these pulp, you know, stories for pulp magazines, and he, you know, he published in Saturday Evening Post with, you know, accompanied by illustrations by, you know, Norman Rockwell, and he published these books, and he published one book about his adventure living on a sailboat during the Great Depression with his family. So I discovered this other Don Waters because I was putting together credits for my CV because I was applying for jobs, and so there are actually websites where you can, you know, type in your name and your, you know, I needed the volumes and all that stuff for, you know, the Kenyon Review, for example. All of that stuff was in boxes, and so it was easier to go online. And I just noticed that this other Don Waters kept popping up, and our names were sort of becoming, you know, intermingled in this vague, electronical universe of the web. And so I sort of started looking into him, and the more I looked into him, I was really kind of fascinated. And then, I checked out a book from the library, and, he's in this anthology with Jack London and Ray Bradbury. And I was like, who is this guy? And, you know, it was just so happened that I was trying to figure out, and I was stuck about how to, you know, continue writing this memoir. And as I started looking into this guy, I saw that this other Don Waters had, you know, this what seemed to me at the beginning, this perfect nuclear family, and he was having these adventures with them. And so I checked out that book, and I just realized this other Don Waters' life was the perfect counterbalance to the story that I was telling. You know, I was telling this pretty, heavy story about, you know, being abandoned and life without a father and being angry and, you know, sort of becoming a writer, and what that all meant. But I realized I could also counterbalance all of that heaviness with this other family's adventures with their life at sea, which is what I do in the second section of the book. I just completely fell for this guy. And of course, as I go through, you know, their adventures, and the more I look into their family, and I really did look into their family because I did an extensive amount of research on them. And, you know, I reached out to their, you know, distant family members to figure out, you know, who they were, what they were like. And, you know, I eventually followed, the daughter, Gypsy. So it was Don and his wife, Margaret Waters, and their daughter, Gypsy. I eventually tracked her down with the help of a private investigator because I wanted to see what happened to this family. And of course, my little myth of the perfect family in the book basically gets it explodes, right?
Yes,
because
yes.
No family is ever perfect. And so the truth is, the stuff that I find out about them is pretty shocking.
Now, did the family members that you reached out to think it odd that you were doing this research?
Oh, yeah. So the first, they found it interesting, but at first I reached out to this one woman because I found her name on a genealogy website, and I reached out to her. I found her, and I reached out, and I said, you seem to be looking for information about the same person. And because my name,
elaborate
name,
a little bit,
she
I
thought
think we'll be fine.
Right away that I was a family member. I was a distant
okay.
family member, and
right.
so she was, hopeful that I was a family member, but I wasn't.
Yeah,
but she was really helpful.
Yeah.
And then I, my approach after that was to explain myself right away about what I was doing. And some people were, harder to find, and some people really, easy to find. Because Dawn's wife, came from this amazing family. And they sort of were, they from Asheville, North Carolina. She mingled in this, high literary circles, because her sister was married to Kenneth Burke. And of course, Kenneth Burke, knew everybody in Greenwich Village. And so, it was sort of easier to track down some people than it was others.
It's interesting that, you have the connection with this person of being writers, same name, you're both writers, but then the sailing and the attachment to the ocean, and it's sort of like connecting
yes.
through
yes.
your father as well, because your father also was a sailor.
Right, right, right. So yes, I mean, it's the love of the ocean, right? It's the being a waterman, being raised near the ocean as my father was. He was a great surfer. He loved the water. And then later in his life, he sailed aboard, he had his own sailboat. And so that was a connection as well. I love water, and it's so funny because when I tell some of my friends, this doesn't just sound amazing to live on a boat in the Caribbean for, for all number of years
and raise your children there.
They would, oh God, they looked at me like I was a crazy person, but, that does sound amazing to me. It does sound, incredible because I do love the water and I do love adventure. And, yeah, that really appealed to me, just like the surfing did, and looking into my dad's surfing past. I'm a big lover of water, and I've always been a lover of water.
Yeah, and it's interesting with your dad, being a surfer, and then he was like kind of a professional sailor for a while, sounds like. And then he went to mining, which is like as far from the ocean as you can get.
Right.
He was in the desert,
right.
And he was, that seems like, and really into geology, that just seems like an odd, it's almost like it was a complete split in his life. But then he did go back to the ocean at the end, didn't he?
Right, yeah. I always found that odd, too. I mean, he grew up in the way that, it's been described to me, he grew up in an idyllic place. He grew up in Manhattan Beach, California. Where kids would just run around without shoes, near the ocean. You could go surfing. You could go watch surfing films with jazz soundtracks. Then later on, his parents moved to Santa Barbara, which Santa Barbara is an amazing place. And
oh,
he grew
yeah.
up, in those two places. And it's like the California dream. Then he got into sailing, and he sailed to Hawaii with, I don't know, what was it, the deputy something of Department of Defense or something? I can't remember, but he sailed all around Baja California. And so for him to then, I think he was trying to just get his life together. That's the best I can, surmise. And so he went to school, and he went to school for geology. And he became a mining engineer, and so basically lived in the deserts around Utah and Arizona and Nevada, looking for, ore and, at these mining sites where there's nobody. It just seems like such a huge shift in his life. And that's always surprised me too. And it's, I try to get at that mystery in the book.
I happen to know a family that the son was adopted, and he has not had a very happy life, although his parents are great people. And I'm just wondering that if it could be because he didn't know his parents. So he feels like there's a void there that he just can't fill. And he's had a very, he's been in drugs and so forth and so on. And so, how do you get over that? How can you do that?
This is a profound question, right? I have a friend who was adopted and read this book and said how much the story resonated. Because it's, I think it's a similar experience where your parents, you have parents who love you, and adoption, is about love and wanting a child. But there's also the other side of that, which is parents who are giving you up. And sometimes those reasons can be really, good reasons. I had to write a book to realize in some ways, and in many ways, it was probably better that I didn't grow up with my father, I had to, think about this for 20 years, go to therapy, write a book about it. So there's a lot of ways in which, I had to discover that for myself. But one of the things that's really helped me is just becoming a father.
Right.
So, I don't know how you, I would suggest therapy. I had the same question, a month ago at a reading. I don't know the answer. The answer is to do a lot of self-searching and go into therapy, because I think therapy did save me. I think I was in a lot of ways on path that was not good for me. And it really helped me, and it deepened my understanding. So what's really helped me too to sort of, I don't know. It's weird. I used to think about my father and my relationship to my father and my relationship to my mother a lot more than I do now. Now I think about my relationship to my daughters and my relationship to Robin, my partner.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing to me.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, actually. It is. And even if you'd had a healthy relationship with your parents, your relationship with your partner and children take precedence later,
right?
Ask you, your partner Robin is also a writer, and you fairly similar paths early on. You both published a collection of short stories. You were pretty successful at placing stories in literary journals and so forth, and then she published a memoir, and you attempted to publish a novel and were not successful. Was that difficult? And are you too competitive as in terms of your accomplishments as writers?
Right. great question. So early on, yes. I mean, early on, we were both writers in San Francisco. She lived in Berkeley. Eventually, I moved over there with her. It was competitive at first, yeah, because it's very hard to get a short story placed in a literary journal. I mean, there's the number of rejections you have to receive before you finally get an acceptance. We were rooting for each other, but we were also competitive. I think in the beginning, there were rough patches, because this is an incredibly difficult, life path to take, to become a writer and to do this. It's just, it's full of uncertainty, rejection. You get some wins here and there. But it's really, it's like you have to sort of be monk, zen about it, to be a monk about it, and, you know, say, I'm going to be creative, and this is the creative path, and, you know, try to not let the all the other noise interfere. But, of course, all that other noise does interfere. So in the beginning, I think we were, and I think now we're older, we're more mature, and, you know, we really just root for each other. And everything she's ever sent out and everything I've ever sent out to be published or whatever, we know we're the number one readers of each other's work. Mm. So, I mean, it really truly is a partnership, just with each other and with our family and then also with our creative lives. And there's something really special about that. And I think early on when she did publish that memoir, it wasn't just publishing a memoir. She published a memoir and it made it to the, you know, front page of the New York Times Book Review. And so it was a big, it was a big deal. I was super proud of her, and I had this this novel, and then I had a big agent, and I was hoping it was going to sell, and it just, you know, it didn't sell, and I, in New York. And so, I mean, that's really hard, because when it's not as though I took a test and I failed. I spent years and years of research and traveling the country and spending my own money, to try to publish that book.
And did you publish it then? Did that book end up being published?
Yeah. I found a publisher.
And is that Sunland?
That's Sunland. It's a really interesting experience when you don't have and I don't think a lot of writers like to talk about it, but when you don't sell a novel in New York, it's painful. Especially when you have an agent who's rooting for you, saying it's exquisite, it's sublime, it's really wonderful. And so you start to think, hey, this is going to work. And then when it doesn't work and then they stop, you know, taking your phone calls, that's a real blow.
Yeah.
I had to move on from that agent. I essentially went out with the book and found a publisher, the University of Nevada Press. They had a great series called Westward Fiction. And so they published it, and it did pretty well.
Now, how many novels had you written before that you did not try and publish?
Because I came from the sort of DIY, do-it-yourself culture of zines and all that stuff, I was always into, you know, doing, you know, publishing things myself. And in fact, I ran a small publishing company in San Francisco when I lived there and published other people's work. In the meantime, I was writing novels, thinking that if I ever wanted to, you know, publish something, I might just publish it myself. But I wrote that first novel in college when I was 21, 22. And I just didn't stop. I wrote, you know, several other novels. I think I wrote four or five novels before, maybe Sunland is my fifth novel. So maybe I wrote four other novels before that. And it was really just me experimenting with how do you do it? How do you write a novel? It wasn't my first attempt. I tell my students all the time, the only way to learn how to write a novel is to write a novel.
Oh yeah.
You can't go to the bookstore and get these how to write a novel books, you know, how to write a character, any of that. You have to read as much as possible and read widely. And you also have to sit down with your butt in a chair and do it. And that's the only way you can learn how to do it.
Well, we are completely out of time, Don. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. And Mom, do you have some?
Thank you.
Do you have some closing words for us, Mom?
Well, actually, I have two things. But the first one is that we know you can't change the past, yours or someone else's, but you can influence the future. Perhaps you can help a child who has an absent parent just by showing them that you care about how they feel.
Well, I love that.
Excellent.
Thank you.